I'm John Krall. Coming up on No Limits, we will talk about the challenges of growing old gracefully and in good health. As people live longer and healthcare costs show no signs of decreasing, the task of taking care of ourselves becomes more and more important. We will discuss the challenges of aging and wellness with our guests, Dr. Ellen Miller, Executive Director of the University of Indianapolis Center for Aging and Community, Dr. Steve Rappaport, a geriatric specialist and the president of AgeWell Health, and Melissa Cusack of the National Institute for Fitness and Sport, and, of course, you. Please join the conversation by calling us toll-free at 1-866-476-3881, emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending questions or comments via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. First, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I'm John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking today about the subject of aging and wellness. We're fortunate to have as our guests Dr. Ellen Miller, who is the executive director, the University of Indianapolis Center for Aging and Community. Ellen, welcome to the program. It's good to have you here.
Thanks. It's great to be here with you today.
Dr. Steve Rappaport, who is a geriatric specialist and the president of AgeWell Health. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. And Melissa Cusick, who is a lifestyle prescription coordinator for the National Institute for Fitness and Sport, NIFS, which is the acronym we'll go by, I suspect, because it's a little bit of a tongue twister. Melissa, good to have you here.
Thanks so much.
Well, I want to start here. I generally start the program, and I should invite our listeners to join this conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I'd like to start sort of by exploring terms here. I think most people out there understand what aging is, so we won't go with that one. But I'd like for us to start, just so we're not talking about different things, by defining the idea of wellness. It's obviously a term that's come into vogue a little bit more in the past decade or so. I'd like to talk a little bit about what we mean by that, in part because I often talk to people and find that they're using radically different definitions. So I'll start with you, Dr. Ellen Miller. Ellen.
Well, I have a probably pretty broad definition of wellness. So certainly there's the physical aspect, the absence of disease and disability, and the physical aspects of wellness. But if you look across the spectrum, there's also mental wellness, social wellness, spiritual wellness, all of the different aspects of life, really, that become so important, especially with aging. I think sometimes we get so focused on thinking of wellness as only the physical that that we really miss the opportunity to think about all of those other areas that when you talk to older adults, oftentimes those are the things that become most important to them. So it's one thing to have kind of the basic health, but then what do I do? I need friends and family and activities, and I need a strong spiritual life, and I need social interactions. So my definition tends to be a pretty broad one in terms of all of those aspects of wellness.
Well, and it sounds like, if I can oversimplify a little bit, it's about, to some degree, achieving some balance in life as well. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that's a great way of kind of summing that up, yes.
Steve Rappaport, what's your definition of wellness? Or did Ellen take yours?
No, Ellen, we all agree with Ellen's point. It's that there's multiple domains, and we're looking at to use the fancy words, a biological, social, and also a physical model. But there's been a large corruption of the word wellness, so that you're right, it means many different things. What I take it to mean are two things. Number one is optimum health at any age, and the second way is, if the word health seems to be a little bit diffuse, it means optimum function at any age. And there's three big domains, the psychological, the physical, and the social, for all three. So you can function well socially, you can function well physically, and you can function well psychologically. That, to me, is wellness.
Okay. Melissa, your definition of wellness.
I think we've had a great explanation for wellness overall. Things that I would add is just with the aging process, how we continue to kind of embrace the changes that aging can bring about. So that can be kind of the challenge, is to continue to excel and be able to do things independently as we grow.
Well, and I guess that actually sets up my next question beautifully. So I thank you for the
segue there.
And that really is, what are the challenges of maintaining wellness as we grow older? What makes it difficult for people to do that? And I'm going to start in reverse order and bring it back to Melissa first.
Sure. Well, physiologically speaking, you know, that can be we lose muscle mass as we age, and we get into some challenges in that area. So muscle is very much a use it or lose it. So since my background's in fitness, that's kind of the area that I'll focus on, staying active, even though, after retirement, sometimes it's very tempting to just sit back and relax.
And Dr. Steve Rappaport, what do you think the largest challenge is in terms of, as people grow older, maintaining wellness?
Time to stop the sloppy habits that you've had. A successful aging involves good choices and good habits. So if you've been making bad choices, you need to revisit them. And if you've gotten into bad habits, you need to revisit those. And Melissa's the perfect one to precede me, because top among them, as geriatricians always like to point out, is exercise. The numerous benefits it has for hearts, lungs, kidneys, brains, every possible organ in the body, and so many people are out of the habit. If you first make a decision to do it, get in the habit of actually doing it. And the reason I say this, I had to do the same thing myself. I went through a long period of inactivity, saw myself wasting away, and said, I just won't do that anymore, and went through sufficient steps until I broke the bad habit and do it regularly.
When you talk about good choices and good habits, what are some of the good choices people should make?
One big one's going to be nutrition. Very easy to get into sloppy eating in our society. It's everywhere. Fast food is everywhere. But what amazes me is how actually easy it is to eat well. For example, at the local buffet restaurant, modestly priced buffet restaurant, I've noticed it is equally easy to choose the corn, the green beans, and the carrots as it is to choose the French fries or any of the fried foods or the pizza. They're right there. If you go in, they're right there. The fruits are in front of you, and so are the desserts. All you have to do is walk to your right rather than your left. It's that simple. Price is the same. The food's already prepared for you. So I use the buffet because it's a metaphor for life. Life itself is a buffet of all kinds of choices. It's just there for the picking.
And what about the good habits or the bad habits that people should avoid?
The bad habits that people should avoid particularly include exercise, but it also includes not taking care of oneself in the broader way. For example, you can probably get by for the first, from the time of adulthood, when you're 20 years old to the time that you're 50 years old, for the 30-year period, if all kinds of people don't get any health care, no preventive health care, they might be able to actually, other than perhaps dental, they may actually be able to get away with it and get by. But once you start hitting 50, 55, why, the prevalence of eye problems, the prevalence of blood pressure problems, the prevalence of all kinds of cardiac problems is going to be so substantial that if you do nothing about it, it'll get you before you can take control.
Ellen Miller, what's the biggest challenge when it comes to aging, to maintaining wellness?
I think one of the things that people like to blame health problems on as they grow older is their genetics, their genetic predisposition. We know for a fact that genetics really plays a relatively small part in how healthy we are as we age. And so I think the biggest challenge is perhaps the good news and the bad news all wrapped up into one is that lifestyle factors, choices that we have, things that are within our control are really probably certainly the most impactful. So eating well, controlling one's weight, the things that Steve has suggested, exercise, limiting alcohol and tobacco, maintaining strong social connections, all of those things are very much within our control. So the idea of growing older in a healthy way, for the most part, is very much something that we can control. Now, that's not always the case because there are certainly predispositions to certain disease processes. But if you look at the list of things, once someone has a particular disease, if you look at the list of ways that you can decrease the risk factors and even improve wellness once you have a disease, it's the same old things. It's eating right, controlling your weight, exercising, maintaining those good social connections, controlling alcohol, tobacco use, all of those bad habits turned into good and healthy habits.
We are talking about the challenges of aging and maintaining wellness with our guests, Dr. Ellen Miller, Dr. Steve Rappaport, and Melissa Kusick of the National Institute for Fitness and Sport.
John, if I may, I wanted to just take a point and talk about the example I gave of blood pressure. The reason I pulled that out of the hat is because it's the paradigmatic silent killer. Mm-hmm. That unless you look for it, you won't find it. I can't look at you and tell if your blood pressure is too high. I have to take your blood pressure. The point of it is a 35-year-old, if no one takes his or her blood pressure, likely doesn't have high blood pressure. Yeah. The prevalence is so low. You start getting to 55, that's where you can find it and do something about it. And if you wait till 70, it may be too late. It's already done the damage. So, silent killer.
So if you're 50, then is that sort of the break point where people, and how often then should they be visiting their doctors?
The line goes straight up. That's why I say pick the choices, take your risk. It's a linear increase, and so that way you can, but very prudent. I'd say age 50 to 55, welcome to middle age. Get yourself checked out for preventive care.
And how often should they do that?
Blood pressure is annual.
Okay. Any other, are there other things that they should be getting themselves checked for?
In today's world, you better know your cholesterol because it can come back to haunt you.
And I want to talk a little bit, and I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, sending a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. One of the things, and I'll speak some degree from personal experience here, when I was younger, I was a competitive triathlete for about a dozen years. And then pretty much ballooned up. I struggled horribly with, once I started to get older and started getting slower, and also, frankly, started getting injured more often, making the adjustment to the fact that I couldn't go after personal records or whatever, that I just, by the standards by which I judged my performance, I wasn't going to do as well. That obviously is part of the aging process. It was not unique to me. It happens to all people. But I think there's something somewhat universal there, that we all struggle with the idea of doing exercise when it's not as easy, it's not as effortless, when you get hurt more often if you try to push things. Melissa, how do you motivate people who face similar challenges?
Same way I motivate an athlete. It's, just because you maybe have increased in years does not mean that you're not still able to do quite a bit of what you used to be able to do. It might just be looking at it a little bit differently. But still with that, athleticism comes in all ages. A lot of it can be just kind of reassessing goals, trying to motivate people to stay active so that you can play with your grandkids long into as they age as well. So there's definitely some motivational tools that, you might use with people who are aging versus somebody who is, in their college years doing, softball or soccer.
What I'm hoping, John, is you didn't take that as an occasion just to give up and say, well, I can't do as well as I used to do, so I won't do anything at all.
Well, I did for close to a decade.
That was my point.
Yeah,
that was my point. I did the same thing. And I made a conscious decision, no, I'm going to stop that, and I'm going to consciously try again.
We are talking about the challenges of aging and maintaining wellness with our guests, Dr. Ellen Miller, Dr. Steve Rappaport, Melissa Cusack. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking today about the topic of aging and wellness. Our guests are Dr. Ellen Miller, who is the executive director of the University of Indianapolis Center for Aging and Community, Dr. Steve Rappaport, who is a geriatric specialist and president of Age Well Health, and Melissa Cusack, who is a lifestyle prescription coordinator for the National Institute for Fitness and Sport, NIFS. I'm going to have to go with NIFS. I just my tongue ties itself into knots when I try to get around all of that. We were talking before we went to the break really about how motivation for trying to stay fit, maintaining wellness, changes as we grow older. And I told kind of a pathetic tale about how I lapsed into slothfulness after being reasonably fit through my 20s and most of my 30s. And Steve made some points and said that I'd given up. Dr. Ellen Miller, I'd like to give you a chance to weigh in on that subject. How do we motivate? Does motivation change over time?
Well, I think that people who our personalities tend to remain very consistent across our lifespan. So I think people who are exercisers, who are put together that way, who enjoy exercising and working up a good sweat when they're younger, tend to continue to enjoy that as they grow older. I think that the important thing to remember is that it may not be as much about exercise as it is about physical activity. So there are people who just aren't going to put on the exercise clothes and go to the gym and exercise in a classroom setting. It's just not sometimes it's a generational thing. Sometimes it's just not what they did when they're younger, and they're not going to change those habits. So I think it's important for us to recognize that gardening, walking, ballroom dancing, all of these different things that we can, if we can make exercise part of our daily lives in terms of physical activity, things that we do for fun, then it becomes less offensive to some people who just simply aren't going to be able to drag themselves out and exercise for exercise sake. So I think framing it in a way that what's really important is to remain physically active. If you're not going to be somebody who's going to go and work out, lift weights, et cetera.
So that, it's got to be something that's not perceived as a chore, but
absolutely,
something that you do for fun. Well, how much, and we'll avoid the E word then, the exercise word, since that seems to push some people back. How much physical activity should people get, and over, does that number change as they grow older? Do the types of physical activity change as they grow older? Dr. Steve Rappaport.
The recommendations are becoming rather clear now. The importance of engaging in activities that you like is obvious, but the problem is that there's certain kind of dancing which you can make aerobic, but it's going to be very hard to make gardening aerobic because of the nature of it. The recommendation nowadays is that older adults should get moderate physical exercise at least 3 to 4 times a week, and that's generally for half an hour. What do we mean by moderate physical exercise? The rule of thumb that's coming out is that when you are actually doing, you don't have to do extreme exercise. When you're doing moderate physical exercise, you are probably not going to be able to talk the way I'm talking right now. You're going to only be able to say a few words to someone next to you, but you won't be able to carry on a regular conversation. If you can, you're not exercising quite enough at that particular episode of the week. So you should do that about three times, and then you can use the other four times a week to simply do the kinds of things that you like, do things that are low impact, do things that perhaps are useful for conditioning or for flexibility, and I'm sure Melissa can tell more about that.
That seems to be teed up for Melissa. What sort of physical activities, or we'll use the dreaded E word here, exercises, should people do, particularly if they've been, you know, inactive for a prolonged period? That was the other frustration in my case, is after taking a better part of a decade off, I wanted to dust off some of my old workouts, and found out every time I did that, I couldn't walk for a couple of days afterwards. So, Melissa.
For starters, I would always recommend doing very gradual work. You're not going to be able to jump into something. Sometimes it's as quickly as a few weeks after you've stopped working out that you're kind of starting to lose what you had worked so hard to gain. That can be very frustrating, but it's very important to not let that be a setback and to prevent you from moving forward. So always starting very gradually. In terms of what exercises, you know, at NIFS, we always recommend overall body, full body exercise if possible. Sometime with people who are aging, you know, you have to look out for chronic diseases and conditions, medications that they're on that might make it harder to get an accurate heart rate, or their blood pressure is always at the same point because of their medication. So we run into that a lot. However, still, if you hate the treadmill, don't do the treadmill. If you want to repeat that was a good one.
Okay, yeah, go ahead. Go for it. If you hate the treadmill,
don't do the treadmill. Right. So we have some, get creative out there. There's nothing to say that you have to do something that you just really don't enjoy doing. There's other exercises to work the same muscle groups that a trainer or a health fitness specialist, that's what they're trained in, to give you variety. That's the spice of life. Just outside of exercise as well as inside your workouts.
And, of course, the marvelous exercise that's continually overlooked, let the water help you, swimming. Mm-hmm. And, of course, everybody gives lip service to the idea that swimming is such a wonderful thing, because if you have arthritis or if you have any difficulties with your joints, the water will help you. It makes it easy to do. But so many people just have an aversion to the water.
Well, and
they want to drink it, not go in.
And actually, that's how I work out these days, is I swim. But some of that also, I put myself through college, actually, by hustling swimming lessons. And I know some of that is, if you don't learn to swim relatively early in life, there is an aversion that gets people. So if it's not something they've learned, that's a little difficult to start doing. Suppose, though, I am 60 years old and I really want to make a change, start following some of the good, making some of the good choices, and you know, adopting some of the good habits that Steve talked about a few minutes ago. What is there a kind of exercise I could start with that's very simple? I mean, will walking around the block for a half an hour do something for me? Ellen Miller, you're nodding your head emphatically. you and Melissa both were bobbing up and down, but yours was
two things. Before I talk about walking, I think that you hit on something that's very important. That there are a lot of people who you say, well, you need to get some activity, you need to start exercising. Oh, I'm too old to start exercising. Well, that is absolutely false. We are never too old to begin exercising, and in fact, there's quite a bit in the literature about even what's referred to as the oldest old, those over the age of 85, who begin some kind of an activity exercise program, show amazing increases in strength, functional abilities, cardiac function, etc. So you're never too old to start exercising. And walking, as you suggested, is one of the best ways to begin. So for people who have been very sedentary and they want to begin, just get out there and walk. One of the challenges with that, however, is there are a lot of people who don't necessarily have a good place to walk. So we need good sidewalks, and we need safe neighborhoods. We need places for the person who's not going to get to NIFS or to an exercise place to be able to actually get out and safely walk, starting with as much as you can do. So if at the end of 5 minutes, boy, you feel really spent, if you think about a 1 to 10 scale of very light activity versus activity where I'm just done. Someplace in the mid-range, you want to be thinking about how much effort you're putting out. If that's 5 minutes, great. Then do 5 minutes for a couple days. Then add minutes, add distance, speed it up. You can kind of judge it yourself in terms of continuing to challenge yourself so it stays challenging.
And Alyssa, I'm gonna throw this back to you, because let's assume that there are some people out there who are as dumb and bullheaded as I was and would try to get back or would start doing something and just want to power through it. What are some of the signs that maybe you ought to back it off a little bit, or that you're in danger of hurting yourself or doing?
That's a great question. So again, with the starting slowly, especially if you haven't been exercising or being physically active, as we're using in replace of exercise, starting out in
euphemisms that will get us through.
Starting out in, like Ellen said, 5 minute bouts, 10 minute bouts, gradually working up, instead of just going out there and saying I'm going to exercise for 30 minutes, that's something that you have your whole life to get up to that. So take your time. So when to stop? This is important to know. Chest pain, really of any kind, stop. If you're having trouble breathing, you can't catch your breath, even when you stop and you're trying to, you're leaning over and you can't catch your breath, that's a good sign. Pain in the arm, jaw, anything that signs of heart attacks, that's a good time to stop as well. Any other ones that you guys can think of?
I just want to add the idea that I'm all in favor of walking as a segue and as a way to begin to become physically active. But I want to point out the comment I made before. Remember that won't be a be-all and end-all. Walking itself is not enough.
We are talking about the challenges of aging and wellness with our guests, Dr. Ellen Miller, who's the Executive Director of the University of Indianapolis Center for Aging and Community, Dr. Steve Rappaport, who's a geriatric specialist and president of AgeWell Health, and Melissa Kusick, who is lifestyle prescription coordinator for NIFS. I'm going to go the easy route on that way and just duck it. I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or sending us an email at wfyi.org. We've actually gotten a question in here from a caller who didn't want to go on the air. But John from Indianapolis said he is concerned about the age limits requested for cervical cancer and breast cancer exams for all women. He wanted to see if you could comment on that. Steve Rappaport, that seems to be the one that would fall most into your wheelhouse.
There's been a lot of focus in recent years about looking a bit, you know, for many years we used what we'd think of as everyday logic and common sense to try to come up with guidelines for screening. In recent years, we've followed those along to see just how productive they are. And it certainly does seem to be true that beyond a certain age, and it's pushing about 65, cervical cancer screening becomes markedly less useful in terms of preventing disease and disability. We're also finding that above the age of 70 years old, that mammographic screening has much, much less utility in preventing disability and disease. That's twofold. It's not just an ageist perception, but remember also that breast cancer is often less virulent for older people than it is for younger people. So in the same way that a 75-year-old man may die with prostate cancer but not of prostate cancer, a 75-year-old woman may die with breast cancer, not of breast cancer, where at 40 years old that wouldn't necessarily have been true.
Why is that?
Because the disease is less virulent among older adults.
Is it just that because of the way our bodies break down?
Even and the nature.
Cancer cells can't spread as quickly then, or is that?
And you could also say that, I mean, we can be philosophical here if we want to talk about disease and say that people who are going to be susceptible to a virulent cancer are going to do it at an earlier stage of their life. And by and large, people who've lived to 75 years old know they're going to have fought off the virulent cancers. They were not susceptible to it and didn't get them.
Lee, welcome to the program. How are you doing today?
Well, I've enjoyed your show so far, but I'm 70 years old, and I still work at a physical job. Mm-hmm. And I like to look at the whole idea of health as three components: rest, nutrition, and exercise. Now, if I don't get a lot of rest one particular night and I feel tired, I don't like to do as much exercise because I think it's putting a strain on the body too much. But my problem is that I don't sleep. The older I get, the worse I sleep. And I thought maybe this was due to caffeine. So I cut down. I tried an experiment. I quit drinking coffee for 3 days straight, but the sleep didn't change. I still couldn't sleep. So I've been looking into things like for the past few years of the effect on the pituitary gland. Maybe that the secretions from that gland is being diminished, and maybe I don't have as much things like melatonin in my system. So I tried to take melatonin. That didn't do any good because it goes through your stomach, and by the time it gets into your bloodstream, it's practically useless, most likely. And then somebody said, well, calcium. You need to take much more calcium to sleep better. And then somebody else said, testosterone. So
okay.
I'll stop right there.
Yeah, let me see if we actually have a couple of people here, I think, who might be able to answer your question. But thanks
okay,
for calling.
I'm going to hang up. Okay,
great. Thank you very much. We'll start, Dr. Steve Rappaport, with you. Let's just take the topic of sleep, because that is a persistent complaint as people get older, that they don't sleep as well as they used to, that they find it harder to get the amount of sleep, and even when they do sleep, they always feel like they're still tired. So,
the big issue is if you feel you're not sleeping quite as long or as deeply as you did when you're younger, you're right. And the reason for that is because physiologically, sleep changes with age. If we take the different stages of sleep, the rapid eye movement, so-called REM, the deeper stages of sleep, the lighter stages of sleep to which it's been divided, as you get older, you have less prolonged periods of deep sleep, you have longer periods of light sleep, you have less rapid eye movement sleep, all of those things. The deeper sleep you have less of, the lighter sleep you have more of, and you sleep totally for less hours. So all of that is true. What's controversial and being debated still to this day is whether older people need less sleep or not. But in general, if you do age successfully in the absence of disease, you should get something resembling a semblance of sleep. For example, if you used to sleep 8.5 to 9 hours a night, and now you sleep 7 to 8 hours a night, that would be physiologic. That would be normal. The big thing, though, again, like I said in the earlier part of our session today, making choices and changing bad habits, one of the many habits that you should get into with aging is so-called sleep hygiene. In other words, have good sleep habits, and those are found all over the Internet at multiple sites. If you look, for example, at the standard advice, you can find them in the NIH website. It's going to be, in general, stop being erratic. Have a fixed bedtime and awakening time. Try to go to sleep at the same time every night because your body is going to get used to it. It's going to have its circadian rhythm, so use that. Don't nap excessively during the day. Fine, take a 30-minute nap. Take a 45-minute nap. But if you're going to nap 2 hours during the afternoon or 2.5, you won't sleep as well. Don't drink the alcohol right before bedtime. Why? Because alcohol is a drug. It'll interfere with sleep. And besides that, it's a diuretic. It'll cause you to go to the bathroom. The same thing's true with regard to the diuretic in the bathroom with caffeine. Sugary foods can interfere because of your stomach function with sleep. And as we've talked about already, exercise regularly. We've talked about that a great deal during today's session, but don't do it right before bed because that'll also interfere. And there's a dozen other suggestions like that.
We are talking about aging and wellness with our guests, Dr. Ellen Miller, Dr. Steve Rappaport, and Melissa Kusek of NIFS. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking today about aging and wellness. Our guests are Dr. Ellen Miller, Executive Director, University of Indianapolis Center for Aging and Community, Dr. Steve Rappaport, Geriatric Specialist and President of AgeWell Health, and Melissa Kusek, who is a lifestyle prescription coordinator with NIFS. I've punted on that one altogether now. I'm not going to try to do all of those multisyllabic words. They just confuse my poor mind. We were actually talking during the break here about really that we shouldn't make, to use the cliche, that the perfect the enemy of the good here. And I know, Ellen Miller, that you have pretty strong feelings about that, so I'm going to throw it back your way.
Thanks. Exactly. You've said it very well. And what we mean when we talk about that with regards to exercise is that we know what the recommended exercise is. Steve talked about 30 minutes a day, 3 to 5 times a week, moderate activity, including different sorts of exercise as well. So strengthening exercise, flexibility, endurance, and balance are typically the four types of exercise that would be recommended. Well, I think where I'm coming from is that there is this gold standard, if you will, of exercise that the literature strongly supports. This is the level of exercise that's going to be beneficial. But we also know that adherence to exercise program, sticking to it, is abysmal. And that when we there are lots of well-intentioned people who begin a program, who stick with it for a while, and then something happens and they fall away from it and they say, well, I'm not going to start again. Or they simply can't work that much exercise in. I think what I'm concerned about is that people, that we think about exercise programs that people will adhere to by making it a part of your lifestyle, by making activity and recognizing that you need to work yourself hard enough, but perhaps not being able to reach that pinnacle of going to the gym so many times a week and working at this level. Any activity is better than no activity. And so even if you can't bring yourself to, or you're not capable of working at that most prescribed, the best case scenario with regards to exercise, any activity is going to be helpful.
Well, and I think you bring up an important point here, because actually, while I love to berate myself for being a slothful person during that period when I wasn't working out, it was also, I'd switched careers at that point, and my wife and I had started our family, had small children. When I was single, it was relatively easy for me to make exercise a priority. If I started each day with 10 things I needed to get done, exercise could always be in the top 5 somewhere. As I acquired more responsibilities, though, and people as they grow older do tend to acquire more responsibilities as they go along, it kept getting moved down the list, so that often I wouldn't get to the 9th or the 10th thing, and if exercise happened to be that. Are there ways that you can fold that into other things that you are doing or meeting other responsibilities? Melissa Kusek.
One of the things that just pops into my head is, I mean, in America, we do a lot of multitasking. So why not, if you're trying to spend time with your family, do something active. Take them on a bike ride. If your child's at their soccer practice, you can take a lap around the field or the park while they're doing that. So I guess in my mind, I'm thinking that exercise or your activity does not have to be in a gym, per se. That's something where you can get a little more specialized, or you can work on certain areas and whatnot, but it does not have to be just either I go into the gym and get this hardcore exercise on and show off to all my friends. It can be something that, you know, you do for yourself as well. That can be your time in a busy day that we all have with families, work that's stressful, et cetera, et cetera. Sometimes it can, I tell some of the members that I work with that this is a time for you, kind of to clear your head. We're not back in the day of the hunters and gatherers where we have to be active to stay alive. Therefore, we have to create some opportunities to keep ourselves healthy and to treat ourselves well.
How would you feel about
Dr. Steve Rappaport here?
How would you feel about putting an exercise bike in viewing distance of your TV set?
Great idea.
Hey, you can ride to the oldies.
Yeah,
let's do it.
Yeah.
What else are you doing when you're watching TV?
Other
exactly.
than, yeah, being, yeah. And it's
eating
a way to.
Popcorn.
Yeah. Or if that's actually one of the healthier choices, potato chips or something that's even worse. We're talking about the challenges of dealing with aging and maintaining wellness here on No Limits. I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881.
While we're talking about couch potatoes, how about a word about diet? We've talked a lot about exercise. What do you think? I'd like to ask my other colleagues here today. If I had to pick the one thing that people don't eat enough of as they get older, it's they don't pay attention to the calcium. We know that you need 1,200 milligrams of calcium a day, elemental. It's simple. All you do with all our labeled foods nowadays is you pick up your yogurt, there's 300. You take a glass of milk, there's 300. You just add it up each day, so you get 1,200 milligrams. And make sure you also get vitamin D, 800 units of vitamin D a day. And it's not that hard to do, but people don't do it.
Well, and I think one of the things that I'm seeing as a persistent theme in this conversation is how important mindset is to all of this. I mean, among other things, making deliberate choices about the diet, paying attention to what you're eating, not eating out of reflex. But I think having an attitude in some of that, I want to take this in a slightly different direction, is culturally we often, and I can say this, I'm north of 50 myself, that we tend to think of middle age and beyond as this period of decline, which is why people who are older tend to deal with depression and a lot of other issues. What are ways that people can cope with that? Dr. Ellen Miller.
Well, I think this is one of my soapboxes, so I'll admit that right up front. But
it's okay.
Age is not.
That's why you have a microphone.
That's
in front
right.
of you right
That's
now.
That's right. So. Age is not a disease. So just because we get older doesn't mean that we automatically become diseased in some way. Now, there are certainly age-related changes, and there are certainly age-related. There's a propensity for particular diseases as we age, but I think people need to get out of the mindset that the age-related diseases are inevitable. Well, I'm going to get osteoarthritis. I'm going to get heart disease. I'm going to get these things because everybody who's old gets these things. And I think that's something that's really important for us to remember. There are certain risk factors. There are the lifestyle factors that we need to pay attention to. And now that I got on my soapbox, tell me the original question again.
Well, it's basically how you deal with depression as you get older, or that whole idea of age as decline. Basically, once you get, you know, we still tend to think of it almost as a curve, a bell curve of some kind. And I'll tell a real quick story to set this up and then throw it back to you. About a year and a half ago, I'm walking through Circle Center Mall, and one of the folks who operates the kiosks selling cosmetics kind of leaps out and steps in my way to try to sell me something, and facial cream in this case, and I said, no, I'm not interested. I was actually running late to a meeting. And as I walk away, the devastating line that was supposed to pull me back was, "Well, sir, how do you feel about the lines on your face?" Oh. To which my response was, "Well, like I earned every one of them." But my point would be that somehow
you're supposed to say, "I'm on radio, it doesn't matter."
Well, that's it. And I do have a face made for radio. But that said, the idea there, obviously, the implication was that age was something we're supposed to be embarrassed about or ashamed of, and that therefore it should be depressing.
And a marvelous excuse to sell cosmetics.
Yes, right. It is. It is.
I think you've hit on something extremely important, that culturally here, especially in the United States, we have this rightness of youth mentality, and there is spoken or unspoken really age-related bias. Mm-hmm. That somehow aging is something that's wrong. You need to fight it as much as you possibly can to maintain the look and feel and activity and of youth. And I think that's something that's not present in all cultures. It certainly is present in ours. Just look at the media. Just look at the ads on TV and the magazines and things too. And so I think that's an opportunity for us. I think it's framing aging in a way that instead of just thinking about it as a challenge, oh my goodness, 77 million baby boomers are going to be over the age of 65. What are we going to do? Instead of framing it as this tremendous challenge that's going to somehow bring us down, framing it as an opportunity. Wow, we've never had this many older adults. What are the opportunities? This is an exciting time of life for people. What kind of volunteerism, what kind of family roles, what kind of social engagement? Will people continue in the workforce? There's all kinds of opportunity. Retirement in the traditional sense of sitting on the porch isn't going to happen anymore. It's not happening. People don't want that kind of aging experience.
Yeah, that certainly is not one that I hear people talking about as much anymore. And, you know, the cliche I often hear is, what will I do if I don't love golf that much, you know, if I retire. Steve Rappaport, you're looking as if you want to say
something. I just
want
to give an analogy because I want people, as you said, life's a bell curve. There's certain times in life where younger people can't do certain things that they can do when they're older. That you know, this idea, for example, all the things that we're talking about, learning to cope with aging. Come on, let's be real. It's easier to do than learning geometry. You learn geometry in high school. It's not that easy, not that hard to make these kinds of choices. And the analogy I give, imagine that, and I'm going to give this as a metaphor. Imagine you've got a 14 or a 15-year-old who needs to get somewhere that's a distance away. The person obviously doesn't have a driver's license, can't drive a car. There's no one to drive them. How are they going to get where they need to go? They'll take a bus or they'll take a bike. Why? Because that's how you get there. You use the same logic with aging. If you're 65 years old, there's something you can't quite do easily, then you take your next best available choice and you use it to get where you need to go.
Bob, welcome to the program. How are you doing today?
Hello?
Hello, Bob. How are you?
Mars Carl.
Well, we're understand that you've got a question for us here on No Limits.
Well, what you seem to be missing is the growth hormone factor. As you get older, it diminishes.
Okay.
If you don't adjust your workout situation to it, for instance, when I start a new sport like racquetball in my 40s, mid-40s, mm-hmm. I played every day like I always do in a sport to train, which I could do when I was 25.
Mm-hmm.
I found out at the end of the first season of racquetball, I was overtrained. My knees were getting soft, okay? If you're an athlete, you know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did, instead of playing every day, I played every other day. And that worked fine until I got into about my mid-50s. And then I had to have 2 days in between. And the factor is growth hormone, your body produces less and less of it as you get into that age. And if you adjust to that, you can do fine. If you just keep that, you know, one day on, one day off, and then you go to one day on, 2 days off in between.
Thank you for the call. Good talking with you. Thanks. The growth hormone question that Bob asked, and really I'll take that somewhat out of the medical terminology here, and really in athletes we talk about recovery time much more than that. Melissa Kusek, Bob's point really is that as you grow older, sometimes with certain kinds of activity, you do need more time to recover. Has that been your experience?
Yeah, and really with a lot of training sessions that'll be out there, they'll have a day of rest, or they'll have a low day, a moderate day, and then a high intensity day. So switching it up, keeping things fresh, and letting your body rest and recover is definitely a very important part of any workout. Whether you're an Olympic athlete, they usually have low days or rest days as well. So just because you're having to put a day or two of rest in there, you can also switch up what you do. Maybe not racquetball every day, but racquetball and then other activities as well.
Well, and I think the other point that you made here is that switching it up, switching activities so that you're not using exactly the same muscle groups day after day after day. And that is one of the differences I've found as I get older, that I even since Steve's already done the Valentine to swimming as a form of exercise, I won't go there. But one of the nice things is that A, your body doesn't get pounded, and B, you can switch strokes. You can use
let the water work for you.
Yeah. Yeah. We've gotten a question here from a listener from who says that he's 59 and hasn't exercised for a long time. And each time he tries to remedy that, he starts doing exercise in a reasonable way, 3 times a week, moderately, but can never go beyond the point where it becomes a habit. People keep telling me I have to stick to it for a month or two, and then exercise becomes second nature. But he says, as I exercise, my whole body aches so much that I cannot seem to keep up with a regular habit I'm supposed to establish. How long does it take before you build up enough strength and your body stops aching? I think, Melissa, that's probably one that should be directed to you.
Sure, and sometimes we kind of hit a plateau. That's something that we, a challenge that we deal with a lot in fitness. So it could be just sometimes a good goal while we change our goals is just maintenance as well. At a certain point, you might not continue to just get huge strength gains each time, but you're maintaining a high level of activity or you're still able to do things independently and well. So,
do you think that listener would benefit from joining a group?
Finding
a little some positive kind of reinforcement, mm-hmm. getting somebody cheering you on while you're doing this stuff, which leads into one last question we're going to have to deal with very, very quickly, which is, I think once a person retires, this caller, Linda Downer, says there is a real challenge in staying socially active. Is joining an exercise group a good way to do that?
That's a great one.
She took it out of my mouth.
Absolutely.
That's too funny. Of course it is.
And a lot of people adhere to exercise simply because of the social factor that, you know, there are a lot of exercise groups that have a great time together and then they go out for coffee. So that's a great way to stick to it.
And remember my comment before about the water, and we said swimming might be difficult. Water aerobics.
Yes. We are very, very quickly, Ellen.
My last thing, we would be remiss to not remind people that if they haven't exercised for a long time, they do need to speak with their physician about beginning an exercise program.
We have been talking about aging and wellness here on No Limits with Dr. Ellen Miller, Dr. Steve Rappaport, and Melissa Kusek. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism. Please do join us next week. Take care.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Jeanette Rhodes, and board engineer, Matthew Sosi. We invite you to join us each Thursday at noon for No Limits, rebroadcast at 8 p.m., and you can listen online at WFYI.org.